Let me tell you a story. I was 18, I had to go into the army, just become a Christian. And I was told I can't go into the normal army because I'm a dangerous element for the army. I'm a Protestant, I'm an evangelical, therefore an atheist could never understand my stupidity of believing in God, they used to say. And they told me, instead of that, we send you to work for 5 years in a factory. We can't send you to a labor camp, the times are different now, but you'll be working for the state and you'll be based at home. You can never leave your home or your town, and you come to work every day for 5 years. But before that, we'll send you to 3 months of indoctrination. You have to go to the real army for 3 months to learn how to shoot and how to defend this country. And I remember I was placed in an area very close to the Turkish border. Turkey was the greatest threat to Bulgaria in those days, so we were counting the number of seconds if a war should erupt, for how many seconds that Turkey should invade us. So it was like 15 seconds or something ridiculous. But I remember they used to train us, and part of our training was the so-called Egyptian pyramid. We used to call it an Egyptian pyramid. It was actually a pile of stones, quite high, probably about 10 meters when it was all erected up there. And that Egyptian pyramid was on the move all the time. Every single day, from morning to evening, soldiers like me were working on that pyramid. And working is a big word. We were asked to move the stones from one location to another. And also people that were troublemakers, according to their understanding, like me, mainly Christians, and some Muslim boys. We were all 18 or 19 years of age. So you could see where the pyramid has been, because the grass would be really smashed underneath. And it was moving, and the moment the last stone is moved up there, then they will start moving it to another location. Totally pointless exercise. But the pyramid was a type of punishment they were using, and every single day it was moving from one position to another. There were different stones in this pile of stones. Some were small, some were so big that it took about 5 or 6 soldiers to push them around so they could get to their new location. I remember that we hated this pile of stones. I remember a day in which one of the bigger generals came to see the situation in this army compound, and he found out, looking at the papers, that many of the soldiers, the young soldiers, had problems with their backs. So he was asking the people there, why is this happening? Why are these soldiers so sick? And our commander used to say, I don't know why. And we all knew what was happening. We were carrying these heavy stones for no particular reason from one place to another just to be intimidated. Until one day. But I'll tell you about that day in a moment. Interesting passage. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is there no healing for the wound of my people? You probably know that, but the balm Jeremiah is referring to is actually a real thing in those days. We probably know more about it than we think. Let me just get rid of these questions and just go to the next page. It was from a certain area, of course, in Israel, even today. And if you remember the story of Joseph, who was sold by his brothers to some Ishmaelites, carrying a load of, remember, spices, balm, and myrrh, you would know that this was actually a very expensive thing. I mean, we all know, I'm not saying anything new here. The Queen of Sheba brought balm among her gifts to Solomon, for example. In Genesis, we hear about this balm in relation to Egypt as well. During the Roman times, we are told that balm was so valuable and so expensive that in the time of Emperor Vespasian, for example, it was always crowned with it. He was always crowned with it when he was coming back victorious. It was a symbol of victory, a symbol of wealth, but more importantly, a symbol of healing. At the time of Jeremiah, a few decades before the Babylonian captivity, the area of Gilead would have been the most visited area by people who had physical problems. In Bulgaria, we have a hill in one location which is visited by people with physical problems because it is believed that they could get healed there miraculously on that hill. So almost at any time of the year, you can see sick people there spending the night, sometimes in ridiculous conditions. Not many get healed. But many believe they can do that. Even today, well, maybe it's more advertisement than a real help, but even today you can find Balm of Gilead treatment. And it is very expensive. And it is believed that it's helping people even now. So the prophet asks rhetorically, is there no balm in Gilead? And the answer is, of course, positive. Of course there is balm in Gilead. This is what Gilead is famous for. Is there no physician there? Well, Gilead in those days was full of physicians. A lot of people claim to know how to apply this balm. So the obvious answer to that question by the people that were listening to Jeremiah was similarly, yes, of course, there are physicians, there are doctors, and there is balm, there is a medicine, and there are doctors. And then the question is, why aren't they people? Aren't then the people getting healed? I was thinking about that the other day. Even today, we need this balm, not for these purposes that were on the wall until a moment, on the screen until a moment, but when the heart is broken. Obviously, prophet was not speaking about the physical balm. We're speaking about another balm coming from Gilead, connected to the spirituality. Because we need this balm when a heart is broken. A heart that is fainting within. Or in the Psalms we read, a heart that is full of sorrow, full of pain, Psalm 38, Psalm 107, subject to oppression. You know, sometimes I dream to have this palm at our disposal when I see the refugees in Bulgaria. You don't have many in this country, I've been told. They went through Bulgaria in huge numbers. And our nation reacted similarly to many other nations. We felt threatened by them. We tried to create such a difficult time for them in Bulgaria. And I guess we succeeded. I'm not proud of it, but we succeeded as a nation to the extent that they now avoid the territory of Bulgaria altogether. But we as a church had to decide whether we wanted to get involved with them or not, whether we would think about them as a threat, or thank God for bringing them to us, because not many of us were prepared to go to Syria, for example, to preach the gospel. We still are not prepared to do that. And it was fantastic how God had prepared someone already among us, a former criminal who became a Christian after so many years in prison, in a prison in Bulgaria, an Iranian national, who is now ministering with us to these people. And it is amazing to see how the Word of God can serve them as a balm on their souls. I don't know, have you ever been able to read a passage from the Gospel to someone that has never heard it before? It's almost impossible to do that in Bulgaria. People have heard something at some point. But now with the refugees, they come and you open the Scriptures. And it's through a translator. I can't speak Farsi, so I speak Bulgarian, and a translator is translating from Bulgarian to Farsi. And you could see it in their eyes for the first time in their lifetime. They hear the story of Jesus. It sounds sweet, but it is actually deeply emotional. And you could see them cry for no particular reason. They've been fed, they're okay, they're warm, they know what's happening. They're safe, more or less, once they're there. But then you could see how the Scriptures are touching their hearts. We've baptized about 200 of them in the last 4 years. Not because we are so keen and quick to baptize people. That's not the point. The point is they have come to the point of meeting Jesus, of repenting for their sins and proclaiming their faith. And it's been a remarkable experience for us. It has changed us more than them, I think. Realizing how powerful the Word of God could be. Another thing was mentioned a moment ago. And this is, if you think about the refugees, this is like on the other extreme of, let's say, the bikers' ministry. I've seen people who have been into drugs and prostitution, big men, that can really, if they hit me in the face, I'll probably be dead, crying like babies when Christ touches them. We've been able to baptize some of them. We have a sticker that we can give to every one of them once a year after they allow us to pray for them on their bikes. Interestingly enough, they never refuse a prayer. Are there any bikers in the room? It's a Christian thing to do. Don't worry. It's okay. It's okay. Especially if we keep to, you know, stick to the rules of speeding. But that's another matter. It's been fantastic to actually see this. I'm yet to meet an atheist who is also a biker. Those two never go together. Bikers fear the road because it is dangerous. They look like fearless, but we're not. Deeply inside, every one of us knows what the risks are. But it's been fantastic to see how these people share not only their desire to be safe on the roads, but also to tell you about their family problems, about their sickness. Some of them are controlling huge criminal entities in Bulgaria and have come now to us to ask for prayer for certain things, not related, of course, with their crime, but about their groups. And we've seen some of them getting to know the Lord. So is the balm needed? More than needed. It is essential to have it. How is the balm administered? Well, of course, through making the gospel heard, seen. And let me tell you, only a fraction of it is the preaching. We pastors know that. After all, we only work one day a week anyway. But we know that the actual preaching is not on a Sunday morning. It is on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. All of these days in which, for example, our building is 24 hours, 7 days a week used. And most of the time, it is not for worship. And some of our deacons have a problem with that. They think the church should only be reserved for worship. And I have a problem with them because I don't believe the church should constitute what the church building should constitute what the church does. We have people coming to work every day there, and I drink coffee with them, and we have all sorts of conversations from Brexit to all sorts of other things, because everyone is shaken a little bit of what's happening in Britain in these days. That's not a secret. And then we speak about their family problems and about their businesses, which are not doing very well, and about being righteous and honest in business. And I wouldn't get a chance to even touch this subject Sunday morning. But on Monday I can, and I'm glad I can do that. And then you have, by lunchtime, the illiterate Roma kids. Now they don't talk about Brexit or business. They talk about other stuff, and they have to be washed first. Their lady's helping them. And you have to give them something to eat because some of them had not eaten for a day or two. And then they learned how to read and write. And how much does it equal 1 plus 1? So it's a completely different setting. And I can't do that on a Sunday morning. But it makes a lot of sense because this is my touch to these people. It's not only me. They're actually professionals who do that much better than I do. But where are we? Is really the balm administered properly? For you who revere my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. I have to be careful with the time. The name of this gentleman is Ivan. The picture to the left is when he was young. I don't remember that time. I wasn't even born. With his wife. She was an Austrian moving to live in Bulgaria. I remember him more like what he looks like on the picture to the right. He was the pastor of our church in that year, 1984, when the communists kind of took over. And in those days, he was really very old because he had spent, and very sick, he had spent 12 years in prison between 1949 and some of the years were in a camp for a while, and then 12 years in prison, almost until 1960, he was there. 1963, even. The church was taken over by the communists. He was expelled from the city. He couldn't stay in the city. He actually lived 150 kilometers away, across a big mountain, so it takes 4 hours to get there. He was then trying to pastor a local, small local church, and I remember visiting him. I was just about to go to this 5 years working in the army, and the church was coming to a point in which we were really afraid that it was going, people would just stop coming. And I visited him, took the service, a young man, and then went to see him in his bed. He was in his bed. He was so weak. It was like final stages of cancer. In fact, he died two weeks later. I didn't know that at the time. So here am I sitting by his bed, and he says, "Teddy, how is the church? How is the church doing?" And I'm saying, "Well, church is not doing very well. We've lost the building, as you know. Less people are coming. People are losing jobs. Some are afraid. I think the church will close down. I think the church will die soon." That's how much wisdom I had at the time. And not only that, I was adding, I have to go to the army and I don't know. They've told me I can't come alive out of there if I speak too much about Jesus. And now I need to go to this factory thing for 5 years. I don't know what to do. So this old sick man, very fragile and weak, he had enough strength to sit in his bed. I can't do that now. But he was able to do that suddenly. So his face came to me like that close. I didn't expect that to happen. And he said, "Listen to me, young man, listen to me." So I was like paralyzed, sitting there, listening to what he had to say. He said, "Listen, when I got arrested, you know, they beat me up for so many days, and I wasn't sure whether it was a day or a night. And at some point, I remember a few days later, they threw me in my cell with blood over my face. They thought I was dying, so they threw me in the cell, and there was that much water in the cell, and my face went into the water, and I was praying at that time, and my prayer was, 'God, your church is going to be killed. They're going to kill your church. And I have no strength anymore, and I can't do anything. Please take my life.'" So I'm sitting there listening, and he goes on with his story. He says, "And while I was doing that, suddenly I realized there was someone in the cell with me. But I was in the water, so I lifted up my face, and I could see, yeah, there was someone dressed cleanly in the cell. And I thought, now they've brought someone in my cell so that if I fall asleep and say something, they can catch me for these words in my dream, and then I could be sentenced." But then while I was thinking that, he said, "This man spoke to me, and he called me by name, and he said, 'Ivane,'" that was his name, Ivan, "'Ivane, the church belongs to me.'" And he says, "And then I went up, and I sat in the water, and my eyes were clear, and I could see it wasn't a man, it was an angel there." He thought he was an angel. And then he said, at that time he said, "The church belongs to me. I died for the church. I decide whether the church lives or dies. You don't worry about that. You be faithful." I'm still listening there. He's looking at me in the eyes. "You be faithful." He said, and the man said this 3 times. And then I realized it was the Lord, and he disappeared. So I jumped and I started singing, and they came for me and they said, "You traitor, we thought you were dying. There's nothing wrong with you." And they took me again, but I was able to survive these 60 days of tortures and then the 12 years in prison. And now I'm here and I'm ready to meet my maker. And who are you to question whether the church lives or dies? Only he can decide that. You be faithful. Now, by that time, I was very ashamed. And he didn't stop. He said just one more sentence. And he says, "And about this army thing, you may be like a sheep among the wolves, but believe me, the shepherd will be with you." And then that was the much of strength he had. He kind of laid down. I couldn't communicate with him anymore. So half an hour later, we left. But I would never forget that moment. This is what shaped me for all these years. Because I was stupid enough to even question, can God be trusted? That's the theme of this book, which contains our story in a sense. Is there balm in Gilead? Yes, there is. Are there healers in Gilead? Well, let me tell you, this balm is given to you and to me, not to mess with it and not to just enjoy it, but to be people who are able to administer it. Yeah, well, there is another question, of course. When is and why is the balm rejected? Yes, indeed, people have the right to reject it. But have we offered it enough? Have we used every opportunity that you have here in Northern Ireland or we have there in Bulgaria, despite of the political situation and our personal differences, despite of what the politicians think or the ordinary people think, to administer this balm? Have we done enough? I hope you can say yes. We haven't done enough in Bulgaria. We need to do a lot more than that. I already said a lot about this political protest, so you just look at the pictures. I'm not going to say anything more. Or the book that is there, you can certainly read it. Let me just finish this story, and this will be the end. So one day, the pyramid was on the move. We were tired of seeing it on the move. And a little, not very strong Muslim boy suggested. He said, "Look, can you see the car of the general over there? I want to do something. This may throw me in a cell for a few days, but let's do something crazy. Bring me the stones here. Don't put them there. Just bring them next to the car." He was the son of a mason. So he started ordering these stones. I was so impressed to see some dry walls down south in Northern Ireland. He started pulling them around. And we started helping him. And this is a boy I've been able to talk about Christ, and he was very receptive at the time. And he managed within 3 hours to build 3 perfect walls with these stones to make them so strong. And all around the car, we didn't scratch the car, we didn't touch the car. But we found some wooden planks, so we created a roof, and he put stones on the roof as well, making it very strong. So at the end of this day, the general came to see what we have done. Initially, he was mad, and then he saw his car was in the shade and nice and cool. So that was the last day the pyramid was on the move. He didn't want to sacrifice the stones anymore, which gave us a great opportunity to then speak about Christ in the time which otherwise we would have wasted and been too tired on the stones. You would say, what kind of story is this one? It doesn't have a good end of someone being converted and baptized. Let me tell you, sometimes it takes more faith to see something so simple happening, like a pyramid of stones being stopped from moving, than to see someone being converted. That's why we lack enough vision and enough faith. God can be trusted in your life and in my life and in our life together. And more importantly, we should encourage each other in the unity that He has given us to trust Him together. There is power in the love among the Christians. We know that because Jesus says, by that they would know that you are my disciples, by the love you have one to the other. Thank you for your attention. Let me just pray and then I'll hand over the word to the rest of the meeting tonight. Lord, I thank you wholeheartedly for the opportunity of being able to share tonight with my sisters and brothers here. I thank you about the way you have worked in the lives of so many of us. I thank you for those that have been before us. I thank you for those prophetic words of your scriptures, questioning every one of us tonight if there is a bound, and if we are called to be the administrators of this bound. It's only in your hands what the people's reaction is. And you are the only one that can judge them for that. But our responsibility is to be witnesses of you in everything we do, in everything we say, in everything we do not say, in every thought that we think, in every gesture that shows our attitude, and in every relationship we have with those that are close to us and with those that are far away. Please make us witnesses for your kingdom. And let us be able to witness about every goodness that we've seen in you, and especially to the grace we find in the death and the resurrection of your Son, Jesus Christ. And we humbly ask you, allow us sometimes to use words for it as well. In Jesus' name, amen.